welcome to another episode of Audie's Oddities. As always, my name is Audie, and I'm here to tell you about the spooky and scary shit happening in our world. I'm not gonna lie, you guys, sometimes I forget to take a big breath before doing that, because I try to do the whole intro in one breath. I feel like it's just seamless that way, sounds a lot better, but sometimes towards the end, I gotta take a little one, because I didn't plan right. But anyway, today we are going to be talking about good old-fashioned murder, unfortunately. Today I wanted to talk about the murder of Ruth Marie Terry, also known as the Lady of the Dune. So this was an unsolved case for decades, I think like 70 years or something like that. And it was just solved this past August in 2023. So let's start talking about it. Ruth Marie Terry was born September 8th, 1936, and was murdered in July of 1974. She was found in Massachusetts in Provincetown at Race Point Dunes, which is what gave her the name the Lady of the Dunes, because she was a Jane Doe for so many years. So Ruth was born in September of 1936 and was from Whitwell, Tennessee. Ruth left Tennessee to go live in Livonia, Michigan, and started working at Fisher Body Automotive. We love a girly that works on cars. Get it, honey, even in that day and age. I love it. And yes, I'm 100% going to be thinking of the scene in Grease when they're all working on Grease Lightning, because I'm a theater kid, and to me that's just how that's going down, obviously. So in 1958, she would become pregnant and give birth to her son, Richard, which she was unable to care for due to money problems from having him outside of marriage. So because she didn't have a man to help her take care of this baby at the time, she allowed the superintendent of the auto place she worked at to adopt her son in return for him paying off all of her debts, which I guess is quite a trade-off. So after the adoption was finalized, she moved to California and tried to reach out to him later around 1972, which was only a year or so before she was murdered, which is crazy. But she discovered that he was not ready to meet her after he had a drug overdose that put him in a coma for 18 days. So unfortunately, she never got to meet her adult son. So we're going to jump to February 16th of 1974. She meets this guy named Guy. Yeah. His name is Guy. Guy Rockwell Moldovan, but we're just going to call him Guy. He was an antique dealer out of Nevada. They fall head over heels very quickly, and 4 months before her death, she ended up going back home to Tennessee to see her family. Years later, family members like Brittany, which was Ruth's grandniece, would come forward and say that Terry wasn't quite herself when she was around Guy, and that he was very possessive of her. So the couple left Whitwell and went to Chattanooga to visit Ruth's half-brother, Kenneth, and his wife, Carol. Ruth and Guy had told her brother and his wife that they were planning to travel around the United States looking for antiques. And they also spoke specifically about visiting Massachusetts right as they were leaving. What a coincidence. Because very quickly, in the late summer of 1974, Guy would return to tell everybody that Ruth was missing from their home in California. And according to the sister-in-law, he told them that he didn't know where she went, but she was definitely gone. And then he just quickly left, rather than, I don't know, staying with the family and wanting help or something like that. Terry's brother even went as far to hire a private investigator in California to look into what happened to her. And the investigator came back to tell the family that Ruth had definitely left on her own after being involved in a religious cult. And I could not find anything about this. So I don't know where he got this information. I don't know why he thinks this. But he believes that she definitely left on her own accord, but it was out of a cult first. So from that day forward, Ruth was officially marked as deceased in family obituaries, but Carol always thought she was just in witness protection program somewhere due to this private investigator. So on July 26th of 1974, a 12-year-old girl would follow a barking dog to the body of a woman in Race Point Dunes, Massachusetts, which, spoiler alert, is Ruth Terry. Hey, you know how I'm here to tell you about the spooky and scary shit happening in our world? Well, I'm here to tell you about something happening right now. Do you love Halloween? I mean, if you're listening to this podcast, you have to, right? Well, have you ever wished that there was another time to celebrate that fun and spooky time of year other than October? Well, if you live in the Athens, Georgia area, now you can! Hauntfest is a Halloween / horror festival business that celebrates Halloween in the spring rather than the fall. So you can get two times as spooky twice a year. The next festival is coming up super soon, April 6th and 7th, and it's going to include some awesome spooky activities. So if you like hayrides, freak shows, fire breathing, live music, trivia, pumpkin painting, animal encounters, a haunted trail, and much more, make sure that you come out April 6th and 7th to the Southern Brewing Company in Athens, Georgia. The festival will also be hosting an array of horror and Halloween-themed vendors, offering things like antiques, tarot readings, original horror literature, macrame artwork, jewelry, and oh yeah, I'll be there. That's right, if you want to come hang out with me, I will be there selling some of my artwork along with all of the other spooky people. Don't miss out on this incredible opportunity for only $15 today when you order pre-sale tickets. For ticket purchases, inquiries, and more info, please visit www.hauntfest.us. And don't forget to follow hauntfest.athens on Instagram for all of the updates about the festival. This year's slogan is, "Who cares about April Fools when you can go to April Ghouls?" At the scene where the body was found, two sets of footprints were found and also tire tracks about 50 feet away from the body. We also learned that this was a very active insect area, which unfortunately caused the body to decompose and kind of be like sped up. So they don't know specifics about when she died. So the victim was laying face down on half of a beach blanket. There was no signs of a struggle, so either she knew her killer or she was killed in her sleep. And a blue bandana and a pair of Wrangler jeans had been folded and placed underneath her head. Her long auburn hair had been pulled back into a ponytail and tied with a gold band, and her toenails were painted pink. And this woman would end up being a Jane Doe for decades. Now, they don't say it immediately, but she had a couple teeth missing and her face was kind of messed up, so it was really hard to get an identification. But what they did know about her was that she was 5'6", somewhere between 25 and 40 years old, and she had some expensive dental work done. Both hands and one forearm were severed and missing from the body, and she was nearly decapitated, possibly from strangulation. One side of her head had been partially crushed with a military etching tool, which looks a little bit like the end of a pickaxe, which I also said in a past episode, but if you look up both of those things, you'll understand why I say that. Okay, just go and look. So investigators initially thought that the missing hands and teeth were to prevent identification, which is smart, unfortunately. The woman would be buried in October of 1974, 3 months after her body was found. So after the case went cold, in 2014, funds were raised for a new casket because apparently the metal one she had been placed in had rusted away and deteriorated. Which is just, and also I didn't know that there were metal caskets, and that sent me down a rabbit hole, but not one we're going to go down in this podcast, okay? I have too much to talk about today. So police start looking through missing persons files. They find nothing. There's no vehicles matching the tire marks on the ground that passed through the area at the time. And the scene where her body was found looked undisturbed, leaving the police to believe that she must have been moved there after she died. And other than that, no evidence was found. So in 1979, a facial reconstruction sculpture was made using clay to give us the first real image of what she might have looked like. Again, in 1980, her body was re-examined, hoping to find some kind of new evidence, but nothing was found. She was examined again in March of 2000 for DNA testing, and in May of 2010, her skull would be used to generate AI images, broadcasting her face throughout the Missing and Exploited Children Center and throughout the internet. So in 1987, a woman had told a friend that she witnessed her father strangle a woman in 1972, and police attempted to find the woman that apparently witnessed this, but failed. Another witness had come forward and claimed that her reconstruction looked a lot like his missing sister, who disappeared in Boston in 1974, which would match the timeline. So we're just going down lead after lead, trying to figure out who this woman might have been. For some time, they also thought that the Jane Doe could have been the body of a famous criminal named Rory Jean Kessler, who broke out of prison in 1973, but DNA testing did prove that it wasn't her. But to this day, we still have no idea what happened to Rory, which is kind of insane. Police also followed leads of two other missing women, but ultimately found out that they did not match. So now I have a crazy theory that I just want to throw in here, because I don't know if I believe it or not, but kind of wild. And this involves the movie Jaws. Yes, the Steven Spielberg classic. So in August of 2015, Joe Hill, Stephen King's son, claimed that he saw a background actor in the movie Jaws who was wearing blue jeans and a blue bandana that looked similar to the ones found with Jane Doe's body. Even though the police did note the similarities, it's very far-fetched, and Joe actually did read The Skeleton Crew, How Amateur Sleuths Are Solving America's Cold Cases, just a few weeks before making this claim. So in my opinion, it's a little reaching. So this body would go on to be a Jane Doe for the next 50 years until 2022, when the skeleton remains were sent to Ortheram, who specialize in forensic genetic genealogy and work to solve unsolved crimes. There, the DNA was matched to Ruth Terry's family members and was officially announced to be her on Halloween, October 31st of 2022. And only 2 days later, on November 2nd of 2022, the MSP announced they were looking into Ruth's husband, Guy, even though he had passed away in 2002 for Ruth's murder. So yeah, sorry to burst your bubble, you guys. Guy has passed away. He's already dead. And unfortunately, this is a very fucked up and shitty man, so I'm going to tell you all the fucked up shit he did, because he died without ever being convicted of any of it. So let's piss off his ghost, shall we? So we have to do the thing where we talk about his past life, and we actually learn about him and blah 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 blah. Alright, we'll do it quick. So Guy was an orphan along with his brother Michael, who was adopted pretty young into a decent family. And in 1942, Guy was living in New York and attending school before he would go to fight in World War II, but was quickly discharged due to a mastoid infection. So on May 11th of 1946, while working as a professor, he would marry a woman named Joellen Mayloop and would divorce her a few years later in 1956. Now, this would be the only one of his wives that got off easy, because 2 years later, in 1958, Guy would marry a woman named Manazita Aline Matzi Ryan, also just known as Matzi, which is what I'm going to call her, and would inherit her 18-year-old daughter named Dolores Ann Marins. Both women disappeared in Seattle on April Fool's Day of 1960, with Guy becoming the prime suspect. He quickly fled Seattle, but was caught by the FBI and charged with unlawful flight to avoid giving testimony about their disappearances. And unfortunately, these two ladies have never been found. July 29th of 1960, Guy married Evelyn Marie Emerson. Guy was facing larceny charges for swindling his third wife's family out of $10,000 around the same time that his second wife went missing. So in 1961, he's convicted of the larceny charges and sentenced to 15 years in prison. But a judge quickly suspended the sentences in March of 1962, provided that Guy just repay back all the money that he took. So apparently if I rob a fucking bank and I go and I somehow triple that money, as long as I bring it back, I'm not going to prison. That's the logic we're having here? That's what you're gonna tell me? So right after Guy gets out of prison, Evelyn and Guy remarry for the second time on August 10th of 1963. And I believe that would be his wife until he passed away in 2002, and I think that she ended up passing away later on, closer to 2020. Interesting enough, a true crime writer named Anne Rule devoted a section of her book that came out in 2007 called Smoke, Mirrors, and Murder to Guy in connection with the Ryan Mearns disappearance. It has an extensive discussion of police's efforts to connect Ryan with the crime, including facts that I didn't find anywhere else online, like investigators finding dismembered human body parts in Guy's septic tank. But they were proven to not be from Jane Doe's body, or Ruth's body. And they also didn't match either of the missing women. According to Anne, Guy was never charged in connection, as the King County prosecutor was reluctant to charge anybody without a real body. But Anne also mentions that Guy married a woman named Terry in February of 1974 in Nevada. So who knows? Maybe she knew him, maybe she watched some of this go down, no idea. But I thought it was interesting. So how do we make a guy worse after he has murdered and dismembered one woman and done who God knows what to the other two? Let's throw on a third murder! Let's throw on a fourth and fifth! So Guy was also the prime suspect in the murder of Henry Lawrence Berard, also known as Red. He was a 28-year-old beer truck driver who was found murdered on a beach. He's also connected to the disappearance of Barbara Jo Kelly, who was a 17-year-old waitress. Barbara and Red were last seen in California on June 17th of 1950, when they went on a little date together. Unfortunately, Henry would be found face down on the beach, dead, the next morning. He was killed with a single shotgun wound to the back of the head, and other than his shoes and socks, was completely nude. Barbara's clothes were found folded nicely underneath his, other than her shoes and stockings, and no Barbara was ever found. So it is believed that whoever murdered Henry kidnapped Barbara. And personally, this is just me jumping in here with my own little theories. Because their shoes and socks were kept on, and because their clothes were folded nicely, it almost sounds like Henry and Barbara were doing something naughty on the beach and were caught and then kidnapped. But that's just a theory. Solely because the clothes are folded up nicely, it could have totally been that they were just walking and being normal people. I don't want to throw that on them, but who knows? I feel like I just need a t-shirt that says, but who knows at this point. So as I said earlier, Guy died in 2002 from a, quote, lengthy illness, but was officially named Terry's murderer on August 28th of 2023. Now, I did want to quickly talk about the Haddon Clark confession, which is a man suffering from paranoid schizophrenia who has adamantly claimed that he murdered Ruth. We could do probably a whole episode on Haddon Clark. Haddon was an American veteran and murderer who was a suspected serial killer, and currently to this day is serving two 30-year sentences for the murder of a 6-year-old girl and a 23-year-old. He was also given a 10-year sentence on top of that for robbery. Now, I believe that Guy murdered her, but I still want to talk about this just because I think it's really interesting. So, tag along for the ride. So, Haddon Clark confessed to the murder, stating, quote, "I could have told the police what her name was, but after they beat the shit out of me, I wasn't going to tell them. The murder is still unsolved, and what the police are looking for is my grandfather's garden." So authorities say that Clark suffers from paranoid schizophrenia, which they say, and I don't like this quote, is a condition which may lead somebody to confess falsely to crimes. I don't think that is a thing in the condition. I think that if cops were beating the shit out of me as this guy either experienced or thought was happening, then yeah, I would confess to some shit too, more than likely. So in 2004, Haddon Clark sent a letter to a friend stating that he had murdered a woman in Massachusetts, and he also sent two drawings along with the letter. One of them was headless, naked woman sprawled out on her stomach, and another was a map pointing to exactly where Ruth's body was found. Which to me doesn't show that he murdered her, it shows that maybe he saw where her body was. Like, maybe he discovered it before that little girl did, but nobody would believe him because he's schizophrenic. So in April of 2000, Clark had apparently led police to a spot where he claimed he had buried two victims 20 years before. He also stated that he had murdered several others in various states between 1970s and 1990s, but no bodies were ever found or connected to him. So on May 31st of 1986, Clark was ordered by his brother to move out of his house. And on that day, 6-year-old Michael Dorr, a friend of his niece, came over looking for her to play. Clark took her to one of the upstairs rooms and stabbed Michelle to death. Clark then drank some of her blood and stuffed her in a duffel bag. He buried her in a park 12 miles away. So, trigger warning, guys. This guy's a fucked up. He is definitely a cannibal. Yes, that's right. I said that. A cannibal. Do I think he murdered Ruth? Probably not. Do I think he's fucked up? Absolutely. On October 18th of 1992, he killed 23-year-old Laura Hogatelli. Clark was working as a gardener for Laura's mother, Penny, when she accused Clark of stealing tools from her backyard shed. Clark had entered the house through the back door and stabbed Laura to death in her bedroom with a kitchen knife. He then suffocated her with a pillow. He carried her body in a bedsheet through a wooded area and buried her half a mile away. But as he moved the body, he accidentally dropped a pillow with his fingerprint on it, which ultimately led to his identification. He later returned and dressed up in a wig and women's clothing and left through the front door to make people believe that Laura had left the house alive to buy time to clean up the scene. So as I said before, police quickly discovered the bloody pillow and linked it to Clark. And Clark confessed and led police to Laura's body 8 months after her murder. Police began looking into him for Dora's murder after discovering he lived 2 houses down from her. So police later tested his brother's old house for blood and found the 6-year-old's blood on the wooden floorboards in that upstairs bedroom, which led Clark to lead the police to her body in January of 2000. Clark then confessed to murdering dozens of people, including the Lady of the Dune. He claims that he had buried the evidence of her crime in his grandfather's garden and that he knew her identity but wouldn't tell the authorities. In December of 2000, Clark would lead police to his grandparents' former property where they discovered a plastic bucket with more than 200 pieces of jewelry. Amongst all of this jewelry was Lauren's high school class ring. So yes, he would have been out at the time of all of these murders and disappearances. But also, he already has murders under his belt. Guy makes sense for all of the other murders. I don't know. Honestly, at this point, now I'm having mixed feelings. I don't know how I feel about it. Tell me how you feel, because that's pretty much it, you guys. That's all we really know. Thank you so much for hanging out with me. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure that you hit that notification bell so that you're told whenever I post a new episode 2 times a week. Make sure that you leave me your suggestions for whatever you want me to talk about. Paranormal, murder, cryptids, I want it all. Send it over to me on my Instagram. And don't forget, as always, check out HauntFest this April. It's getting close, you guys. I am so excited. And of course, as always, my name is Audie, and this has been Audie's Oddities.